Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Hello, everybody.
I'm John Zipperer, your week-to-week host, and I'm very glad you could all come out here and join us today. I hope you enjoyed our social hour before the program. We're going to talk about some of the hot topics of the week. In fact, some of the hot topics of the day, even of the last hour, actually. We'll bring in some of your questions and the comments, and we'll wrap it up by pairing two contestants for our week-to-week live news quiz here. Both contenders are going to receive a copy of California Cuisine and Just Food, and the winner will also walk away with this bottle of priceless, well, 2.5-buck chuck. Buried in a time capsule for 1,000 years, it'll be priceless. Of course, this is a program that's full of opinions, so it is always good for me to note that any opinions expressed here, either by our panel here or in audience questions, are those of the speaker, not necessarily those of the Commonwealth Club, our members, guests, or supporters. And a quick programming note, later this month, the Commonwealth Club will be presenting Sal Khan of Khan Academy. That program will take place in Palo Alto on Thursday, September 19th at 7 p.m. And our next week-to-week political roundtable will take place the evening of Monday, October 14th, up in San Francisco, so please join us if you can. Now let's meet our panelists. I'm going to start on the end. Bill Whalen, he's a research fellow here at the Hoover Institute at Stanford University. He's a frequent analyst on various news channels, and you can read his lively commentary on Hoover's blog, Advancing a Free Society. And you can follow him on Twitter at Hoover Whalen. And in the middle here is Josh Richman. He's the state and national politics reporter for the Bay Area News Group, appearing in the San Jose Mercury News, the Oakland Tribune, Contra Costa Times, 15 dozen other papers. You'll want to follow his lively commentary on the political blotter at ibabuzz.com, and you can catch him on Twitter at Josh_Richman. There are question cards spread throughout throughout the chairs. Write out your questions. We'll be collecting them. During the second half hour, we'll answer as many of them as we can. I'll also try to work in some of them during our discussion here in the first half of the program. So let's get started with our first topic, and that is, as I alluded to earlier, kind of the topic of the hour, week, month, Syria. President Obama, just an hour ago, in fact, addressed the nation and basically said, well, hold on. We'll see what's going to happen with this plan. Bill, what do you think about the way President Obama has been handling this challenge?
Roundabout comes to mind. Circumstances working to his advantage now. As a child of the TV age, I remember on Saturday mornings watching Roadrunner cartoons where invariably Wile E. Coyote would start on the edge of a cliff, fall off the cliff, go through about 10 gravity-defying, death-defying situations and somehow end up back on the cliff, panting out of breath, wondering how he got back there. And that's kind of the president's situation at the moment. He gave a good speech. It was clear. It was coherent, which is the advantage of the commander-in-chief speaking instead of four or five people speaking at the same time, sometimes stepping on each other. The challenge, I think, is simply this. Stop me if you haven't heard a president say that we're not going to go into another country, we're not going to put boots on the ground, we're doing something out of our moral outrage, we're doing something because the world is outraged, even though the world's not necessarily behind us on this, and it's for the good of our country, it's the good for our national security. He has a very, very difficult country to convince on this.
Josh, what do you think about the political aspect of this? I mean, he doesn't even have a lot of his own party behind him.
No, he doesn't.
He doesn't even have most of his own party behind him, I don't think so.
No. Let me preface my comments by referring to your disclaimer about the opinions being only those of the speaker. As a working journalist, I have no opinions whatsoever, obviously.
just the facts, just the facts.
But I think, you know, from a political standpoint, yeah, you know, he found himself in a very difficult spot. You know, it's not a partisan divide. He's used to dealing with partisan divides, you know, but when you've got John McCain for it and Mitch McConnell against it and John Boehner for it and predictably Barbara Lee against it, but Barbara Boxer for it, you know, it's
right, the very hawkish, like, Barbara Boxer and Nancy Pelosi.
Yeah, you know, so it's like herding cats for him, obviously,
right.
and you've seen the result. And I think Congress is more than happy to have this proposal from Russia put forth. although I hope that they are taking it, as Secretary Kerry suggested, with an iceberg-sized grain of salt, because you have to wonder what Russia's motivations are in floating a proposal like this and whether they're actually concerned with removing chemical weapons from Syria, or if they're seeing this as a political tactic, a stall tactic.
Here's the thing. If somehow John Kerry can sit down in Switzerland with his Russian counterpart and begin a process whereby we actually do have an international group go into Syria and work on taking out chemical weapons, and he avoids firing cruise missiles, and that poor midnight to 6 o'clock guy in some warehouse in Damascus doesn't get killed as a result, yeah, Obama can stand up and say that, look, I took away chemical weapons from this very bad man, and nobody got killed.
That's the best case scenario.
Best case scenario.
Which didn't exist until 36 hours ago.
Not going to say it's going to happen. It's incredibly complicated. How do you put people on the ground in Syria? Doesn't that mean that you're keeping Assad in power? At some point, how do you check on these weapons? We did this with Gaddafi, and it took about 8 years, I think, to actually start finding things and get it done. So it's not like this changes overnight. But that said, he can say that, look, I leveraged this situation.
What do you think about the whole aspect of him going to Congress and asking for them to vote on this? He wasn't originally going to do that. We saw in the United Kingdom where Prime Minister David Cameron, of course, presented this to Parliament. Parliament, I don't know if any of you watched that debate. I thought it was a wonderful debate because you had people, they weren't talking points. I mean, they were making professional arguments, but very good arguments, very serious arguments. And, of course, Parliament voted fairly narrowly, but they still voted against the involvement in this. And the Prime Minister said, I disagree, but I'll abide by that. What do you think? I mean, Obama...
I don't know why he didn't wait a week until Kerry comes back from Switzerland and maybe we have an idea of progress.
Yeah.
But I think the problem is here, he looked at the calendar. Question is, why did he do this on Tuesday? Why did he do this on Monday or Sunday, for example? Sunday night and Monday night are football nights in America. There's a more powerful force than the President of the United States of America, and that's the National Football League.
Yes.
So he's not going to dare attempt that. But if he waits a week or waits 2 weeks, he runs into another problem, and that's the timing of Congress. Your intrepid Congress has two very big problems on its hands that it's supposed to solve in the next 6 weeks. One is to come up with some sort of budget fix, a continuing resolution, an entirely new budget, which is due by October 1st, which is when the new fiscal year begins in Washington. The other problem is the fiscal cliff. The nation's ability to borrow money expires sometime in the middle of October. We're headed to the cliff again. Congress has been out for 5 weeks this summer. How many of you take a five-week vacation? Congress gets a five-week vacation for a job well done. Congress went away for 5 weeks. It's come back. It's going to take off again the week of September the 23rd and solve all these problems. So perhaps Obama's thinking is that I'd like to wait a week or two to talk to Congress, but by then we're in the middle of budget hell.
I think the practical concerns of scheduling had a lot to do with it, but much as I'm usually the most cynical and skeptical person in any given room, let me also float the idea that maybe his inner constitutional law professor took over for a second, and he thought, well, you know, this is something that almost my entire base opposed having happened under the previous administration. Maybe I actually do need to try to go sell this to the Congress and the American people.
When Rachel Maddow, the MSNBC commentator, was at the Commonwealth Club a year or two ago, she was talking about a book she had written on kind of the history of military constitutional issues, and she was making the point that the framers of the Constitution made it very difficult for this country to go to war. You know, they wanted it to go to the fractious, arguing House of Representatives because chances are, you know, they couldn't agree to supply themselves oxygen if they wanted to.
Well, Thomas Jefferson sent people into Tripoli in 1805, so... You can kind of read history what you will. I remember that Saturday Night Live skit. Remember that great Monty Python Saturday Night Live skit of what if Napoleon had a B-52 up at Waterloo? So, you know, we can only guess about history. But I do think he was up against a timing problem with this speech tonight, in addition to the message problems and logistics problems and all that. But again, it was not a very bad speech. I just don't know if it moved the needle.
So now we're just in a situation of waiting for, I believe, the Thursday meeting is between the Secretary of State and his Russian foreign minister counterpart. Is that on Thursday, I think?
I think it is.
Okay. Well, he can make another speech then and save us. You actually brought up something which is another topic we wanted to talk about, and that is the triumphant return to Washington of Congress. Let's talk about one of the biggest things on their issues, which is on their plate, which is the whole budget, the debt limit, all this fun stuff. I suspect we're not going to see a lot of the same cross-party breakup between where people are coming down on this. It's probably going to be a bit easier to guess. What do you think, Bill? What are we going to see?
I think as much as the media want to portray Barack Obama as being in the worst situation in Washington, there's somebody with the worst job. That's John Boehner. John Boehner cannot collect votes in the House to pass a Syria resolution, which he supports. John Boehner cannot collect the votes in the House he would like to pass a budget. And John Boehner cannot collect the votes in the House he would like to have to deal with the fiscal cliff. And why is that? Because Republicans are fundamentally divided on issues having to do with war, issues having to do with spending, and issues having to do with using the fiscal cliff negotiations for leverage, mainly to take down Obamacare.
I mean, from what you see, and especially, I mean, it would be reflected in the state level as well, but I mean, are you seeing, of all those divisions in the Republican Party, is someone kind of coalescing as like a new establishment there, or is this kind of extended warfare within the party that needs to take place?
It's a long discussion Republicans are going to have through 2016. The Republican Party is a hierarchical party. There is a saying which Democrats love to use at Republicans' expense that when it comes to choosing a presidential nominee, Democrats fall in love, Republicans fall in line. And if you do go back to Reagan, though, there is a history of the guy who finishes second gets a nomination the second time around. Using that logic for 2016, that would be Rick Santorum. But I don't think I know a Republican who believes Rick Santorum will be the nominee. So it's a very wide-open process. It is a party without a true natural leader. At the same time, you have deep philosophical differences within the party. As I mentioned, over the war, over the course of federal government, strategically, the Republicans think the party has to expand the base. That would be Jeb Bush and Marco Rubio. Mm-hmm. There are other Republicans who think the party has to double down on social conservative politics. You have the Tea Partiers. It's a mess that has to be figured out by the Republicans. But as you look at the schedule for September and October, perhaps the budget can be, if not set aside, just kind of papered over for the moment. Nothing stopping John Boehner and Senate leadership from sitting down and working on an agreement whereby they do a baby mini congressional resolution which pushes the budget into, let's say, December.
Yeah, but I think the big battle is going to be over the debt ceiling, not
right.
over the budget,
that,
right?
That said, yeah. You then get into the debt ceiling, and that's the question. Boehner does not want to turn the debt ceiling talk into a referendum on Obamacare. On the other hand, there are Republicans in Congress just itching to have this fight, and the party's going to have to hash out where it goes.
It's so funny because, I mean, it wasn't that long ago that the prevalent narrative in the Republican Party was adapt or die. You know, they realized that things had gone wrong last year. And there was, if we want to win another national election, we're going to find a way to do immigration reform. We're going to do this. We're going to do that. And how's that rebranding going?
Well,
I amused myself a little too much. Let's move this over here. The Obamacare battle that they chose to make the center point, the centerpiece of the recess,
right.
That didn't go so well for them. Instead, you saw people like Kevin McCarthy and Gary Miller and other people here in California across the country mm-hmm. sort of beset by people saying, get the job done on immigration reform. And that became one of the narratives.
Right.
Now they're coming back. They're not going to stop Obamacare. They're not going to get immigration reform. And they're going to pick this fight. But I don't see the scenario in which it accrues to their advantage.
No, that's the frustrating thing. It's a fight that they're going to lose.
Yeah.
It's, look, Newt Gingrich in 1995, I believe it was, a long time ago, 1995, picked
government
a fight
shutdown.
With Bill Clinton over the government.
Yeah.
And there was a shutdown. Republicans lost the shutdown. And why was that? It's the visual of things. There you are, the Republicans, arguing on the principle of size and scope of government. At the same time, you have these very vivid images in front of you or people who are denied services, people who can't get into national monuments, misery on display. You lose that from a simple PR standpoint. Any government shutdown, the sequestration is the same way. You can talk all day long if you want to about principle and limited government and the horrors of long-term debt, blah, blah, blah. But guess what? That person who cannot get into the White House tour, they're going to trump it. And so Republicans, I don't know why, it's the person who butts their head against the wall and you ask them why they keep doing it because it feels good when I stop. They insist on continuing to want to butt their head against the wall on this and they're just going to lose.
Now, is the sequester as hated in Washington as they talked about it being feared before it happened? because it did come in and it did reduce spending, correct?
Right.
So do you think there's a certain degree of, oh, we really hate this thing, but it is taking some pressure off the spending threat, the spending issue, if nothing else?
Gosh, I don't know. What do you think, Josh?
A bit of cynical.
I don't think it took any. If anything, I think it took some wind out of the Republican sails to cut spending. Because here we are, we have cut spending. Nobody's terribly happy about it. You know, in the individual cases, essentially, mm-hmm. They're still smarting over the tax deal that they struck with the last budget agreement.
Right.
And so that's going to complicate their, you know, coming to some sort of kumbaya moment on this one. So I don't think that which came before is going to make this any easier in any way.
I guess the question is, should you have this big knockdown, drag-em-out fight in 2013, or maybe focus on more political matters, such as winning the Senate in 2014 and trying to get your party in order so that you go in the White House in 2016? And then, in theory, if you had a unified Republican presidency and Congress in 2017, then maybe you could do these things.
I always assume if anything meaningful is going to happen in Congress, it's going to happen in the first 6 months of a Congress.
Yeah,
and we're past the window. I just don't see it happening.
So how many terms of President Hillary Clinton do you think it's going to take the Republicans to come to that moment of...
Well, you can take that one.
Thank you. Somebody's listening.
Let's move on to, I mean, if Washington is a little dysfunctional, let's talk about Sacramento.
Yes.
Bill, you were talking about some deadlines. I believe it's this Friday that they're coming up on.
Friday the 13th. They need to make. Quick show of hands of people in here who've worked in Sacramento. What a smart audience. Josh spends his time in Sacramento. I am a recovering Sacramentan that I wrote speeches for a governor in that town for the better part of 6 years. And it is an interesting place to be. The legislature adjourns on Friday the 13th, ominously enough. And a funny thing happens in the last week of the legislative session in Sacramento. There is a mad dash to get out the door and stuff as much legislation as you can into the bag before you get out and send it to the governor. Much of the time, the legislature is voting on matters that they don't know they're voting on. It's a little thing called gut and amend, whereby a bill passes a committee, and once it's out of the committee, you take it, you tear the stuffings out of it and put something entirely new into it, put it on the floor, the members who vote by proxy. As Gilbert Sullivan said, they vote by their party's beck and call. They vote for the measure, and out it goes. So it's a real zoo to watch. And in this last week, you're seeing a mad dash on matters such as a downtown arena for the Sacramento Kings, a deal for housing prisoners. One member has got an amended bill to deal with condoms in the porn industry. And on it goes. Your government at work. And to me, it's interesting to look at because I remember it was exactly 10 years ago at this time that we were looking at a new governor coming in, Arnold Schwarzenegger, who talked about maybe putting an end to such practices, but it didn't happen.
Yeah, you see how well that went.
Yeah.
a couple of observations. First of all, I usually cover Sacramento from afar, which keeps me a lot happier because we usually have a Sacramento reporter. We're between Sacramento reporters, so I'm going up tomorrow for the rest of the week. Thrilled. I would also observe that not only is it Friday the 13th, but it coincides with Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement. read into that whatever you like. Yes, you know, the gut and amend circus goes on. There's a marijuana regulation bill that died on the assembly floor in May, and don't you know, it's back now. You know, right. just came back, and gutted and amended into two parallel bills. We still have a huge number of gun control bills that need to be voted on as the week goes on, including some extremely strict gun control bills that would put California far and away back in the position of being the strictest state in the nation. We have a very controversial bill to regulate fracking, alternative oil extraction means. Which is a very strange thing to watch because, you know, it's still being amended in these final days, and you've got some people among the environmentalists who don't want this bill enacted because they believe that nothing but a moratorium will do, and this is a regulation bill, essentially. And then you've got the oil industry, which doesn't want regulations,
right.
So they'd like to, you know, go the other direction. Then you've got this small, strange coalition in the middle that's trying to enact it.
But the matter of most importance, will there be a Willie Brown Bridge?
Will there be a Willie Brown Bridge? All right, my turn to ask for a show of hands. Who wants the Bay Bridge named after Willie Brown?
Oh!
there you go.
For those of you listening on the audio, I didn't see any hands.
Yeah. So, yeah. I don't understand how that was a unanimous vote of the Assembly, given that those Republicans still think he's the devil incarnate.
It was a 60-0 vote, meaning that there are, what, 55 or so Democrats in legislature, I think? So it means at least 5 Republicans were there and conscious and voted for this.
Who are they and why? These burning questions.
What do they want from Willie in exchange? But, again, this is a good question. As we all complain about Washington, Sacramento finds its way into meddling. In fact, just last week we had a county in Northern California, Siskiyou County, which is in Shasta Cascade. It's way up the northernmost part of the state. This is an enormous county. It's about geographically the size of Connecticut. Population-wise, it is about 1/230th Los Angeles County. It's about 40,000 people, I think, in the entire county. And they voted to secede and form the great state of Jefferson.
Right. They want to join some other counties in forming the great state of Jefferson.
That's Thomas Jefferson, not George Jefferson.
Right.
Though I do think moving on up would be a great state anthem.
Yeah. I have to think they didn't think it through.
You think we're going to see more protest movements like that?
Well, there is a frustration in the state, and we sit in the Bay Area. We sit in an area of incredible wealth. Unemployment here in Santa Clara County is about 7.5%, I think. Klamath, it is 11.5%, I think. There are pockets in California where unemployment runs 20, 30, 40%.
Wow.
For as much as we historically talk about a north-south divide, which is usually around those god-awful Tehachapi Mountains that nobody likes to drive through, the real divide in California is coastal versus inland. And it's NPR versus Rush Limbaugh, and people who want gun control versus people who cling to their guns, as Barack Obama famously said. And people on the outside in very red counties now, Siskiyou voted for Mitt Romney, who feel left out of the process because Sacramento doesn't vote their interests. But they can secede. They can try to secede if they want to. It's been going on up there since, I think, 1940 or so. But that's the frustration that you see.
They would need approval from the state to do that, wouldn't they?
And the federal government as well.
And the federal government.
State, the federal government, and I think they'd have to get a bunch of counties. So the idea of the great state of Jefferson is about 5 counties in California and Oregon. Siskiyou being about halfway between Salem, Oregon, and Sacramento. Salem being, of course, the other great nut house of legislative bad ideas in America. Thus sending every Oregonian in the crowd.
Well, let's move on to our next topic.
And this now they're all depressed.
You sound dejected.
I'm not filled with as much excitement about Sacramento as you are, Josh. Good luck.
I love my job.
Okay. Well, actually, I do. We talked about this a bit before the program, and that is all the stuff that's going on. You know, last minute stuff in Sacramento. Who's reporting on it? Who is letting this be known? This is the first I've heard of this, you know, last-minute rush to get out really stuff that doesn't even meet our usual high standards of legislation in this state. But we've seen, and this is going to sound like kind of a typical journalism, woe is us, there are fewer of us and we're not paid well, but I mean, we have seen fewer and fewer people in Sacramento covering it for the rest of the state.
And we're not paid well.
What effect do you think that has on citizens, on their...
One is just simply an information curve. Those of you who watch TV here in the Bay Area, there is only one station here that has had a Sacramento correspondent, and that's Nanette Miranda with KGO, and she was just told her services are no longer wanted. So she's going to leave in October. There will not be an out-of-town TV reporter in Sacramento for L.A., San Francisco, every city in California, and Californians tend to get their information first from the news. We're also in an age now, as Josh can tell you better than I, of newspaper downsizing. Mm-hmm. Staff's getting smaller. Newspapers discussing their fundamental issue. The Los Angeles Times, for example, is up for sale, and part of the debate about the LA Times is not just who buys the LA Times, but what direction the newspaper goes in. Will it still be a very aggressive statewide international paper, or is it going to sort of retreat into a more LA County shell and report just on local issues?
Mm-hmm.
The loser in this is you, the voter, if you care about your state government, because you just can't get all the information you need. Sometimes, you know, the media hit it big. For example, there was great reporting done earlier this year on some very bad things going on at the Fish and Game Department in the state of California. But a lot of the things like the Gannett things we talked about just don't get reported out there. Now, part of it's the state and the media, but let's be honest. We, the Californians, bear a bit of the brunt here, too. Why? We got interested in government 10 years ago because why? There was a celebrity involved all of a sudden.
Yeah.
You know, interesting guy with an interesting wife and interesting hair and a lot of interesting things going on about him. Now we've got Jerry Brown as our governor. Jerry Brown's a very devoted public servant, but that said, Jerry Brown first ran for office, I think, the same year that Barack Obama was a second grader. So Jerry is not necessarily cutting exciting action news, and so we're not tuning in. So Sacramento out of sight also becomes out of mind.
I would submit that Jerry Brown is actually a fascinating character, but he lacks the accent and perhaps the accessibility of his predecessor in
a certain way.
He's interesting in the sense that he really does like, he is something of a wonk, and he does like to engage the media in a way that his predecessor definitely did not. He's the guy who his staff actually needs to drag out of the editorial board.
How many people are in his press office right now?
I could not tell you. It's much smaller.
It's only like two or three people.
Compared to like 10 people for Schwarzenegger.
Don't you think he's more intimidating than the Terminator was? I mean,
well, he's getting a lot more done.
Yeah.
You know, I think I don't see how anybody could make a case for anything else. I mean, just take the prison deal that he managed to get in the last couple of days.
You know, he explain what that
means. You know, so we have this situation where we're under a court order, a federal court order, to reduce our inmate population because we're overcrowded to the point of cruel and unusual punishment. And we continue to face a December 31st deadline for getting down to 137% of capacity, right. I believe it is, down to that. And we've already reduced our population by about 45,000 in the last couple of years. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it is not an easy boulder to move. And then we had two competing proposals on how to do this. Jerry Brown managed to get Assembly Speaker John Perez, as well as the Republican leaders of the legislature, both the Senate and the Assembly, on board with his plan. Daryl Steinberg and the Senate Democrats went a different direction, which did not involve finding more prison beds, which is essentially what you know, the centerpiece of Jerry's plan, the governor's plan, excuse me.
we get
colloquial sometimes. And we've just, they've struck a deal now. You know, that they have a plan in place. That was one of the things we feared was going to be happening at, you know, in the wee hours at the end of the session. They seem to have a deal that they can all agree on. Whether the court agrees and accepts it remains to be seen, but there are some positive signs that may happen. Right. But he brokered this. He brokered some form of pension reform. Not everything we needed, but something. Right. You know, he has made things happen, somewhat unattainable things for a long time, in a way that his predecessor simply was not able to do. And that is because he gets people in the room together. You know, Schwarzenegger was a governor who never would have been governor if he had had to win a Republican primary, right, which he did not. And that's the lesson of 10 years ago.
Right.
You know,
Arnold was long on showmanship as a governor, and Arnold was of the belief, kind of like a shark, that motion is always required. I always have to be out doing something. I have to be giving a speech. I have to be doing an event. There has to be a big public prop stage behind me. It has to be showbiz. Jerry Brown is the opposite. Jerry Brown gives you very short state of the state speeches, 10, 15 minutes or less. He rarely goes before the public. He sort of saves his fights when he needs to. It's kind of government on an as-needed basis, as-need-to-know basis. Kind of like the NSA, I guess, in some regards. But no, it appears to be working for Brown. But the one thing that helps most for Brown is just a startling lack of competition. There's nothing really... Ask yourself, when he wakes up in the morning, does he fear for his reelection? Does he fear for being recalled? No, he really doesn't have any competition, so it's in that regard, it's good to be the king.
I think of when I was up in Sacramento in May for the May budget revise rollout, and Senator Bob Huff, the Republican leader, was out there in the hallway after the governor's press conference, and he basically his line, and this is, you know, this is the opposition speaking, was, it's okay. You know, it's like, you know, there's he doesn't really have on some of the bigger issues, there's no organized, you know, loyal or disloyal opposition, and when there is, he manages a way to you know, bring them
but
into the
part
fold.
Part of that is the Republican existence of Sacramento. Republicans have less than a third of the votes in the two chambers. Republicans have to pick their fights very carefully, and the last thing that Republican lawmakers can afford to do is make Jerry Brown unhappy. And why is that? Because Jerry Brown is your one thin line, to use the thin line analogy yet again this week. Jerry Brown is your thin line between yourself and a lot of bad legislation you can't tolerate. In other words, a Democratic governor, if you're a Republican, a Democratic governor is going to sign a lot of bills you don't like. But there are a handful of bills each year that just absolutely drive you up the wall. And you hope that Brown, because he's a little older, he's a little quirkier, he's just unconventional as a Democrat in a lot of ways, you're hoping that he's just going to veto those for the sake of
it. And it's by design on his part. He talks about his canoe theory of government. You know, you paddle a little bit on the left and a little bit on the right, you know, and it sort of keeps you on the straight course.
So. And he's opposed to the naming of the Willie Brown Bridge.
Nor is he there for the bridge for the other spans opening.
Well, he's going to name that after himself. I don't know. What kind of governor do you think? Okay, so he basically doesn't. I mean, can he do whatever he wants? Is he getting everything he wants?
No, he's not a dictator. He can't get anything.
Well,
he wants.
Okay, he's not Assad, but he's got 190% of the legislature in the state is Republican. Excuse me, Democrat. No serious opposition for him.
Yeah, but he's in kind of an interesting box when you think about it. He is 70. How old is Jerry right now? Jerry is 76, I believe. So I assume his time has passed to be running for president of the United States, unless he becomes a Republican. So the presidential thing is out of the way. He can be a voice in national politics, but because he's not on that upward ascent, it's not quite the same. Yeah. If he wants to do big, ambitious things in California, there's a lot of resistance. For example, he wants to build a north-south water tunnel, which has not only cost a lot of money, but there are a lot of environmental-friendly people in the legislature, members of his own party, who are not too wild about this.
So this is
kind of the box. He can't do the national thing. If he wants to do something big like his father, which is build the universities, build the highways, he's kind of limited. So he doesn't have a lot of great options. He has the freedom of not being threatened. He has the easiest path in America, arguably, to re-election come 2014. But if he wants to do something just gangbusters between 2015 and 2018, I don't know.
So, Josh, not a transformative governor, but an efficient governor, a powerful governor?
And I'd say an efficient governor, a governor who's managed to clean up some messes that had previously been called almost intractable. Perhaps not to everybody's satisfaction, but, I think he is a fan of not letting the perfect be the enemy of the good on a lot of these things.
Right.
Yes, I don't think Abel Maldonado or Tim Donnelly, the two stated Republican gubernatorial candidates thus far, are going to suddenly surge in popularity no matter what continues to happen with prison realignment or this prison deal or whatever else comes up in the next year or so. But, I think he relishes being the adult in the room, the big boy. I don't mean that disrespectfully. I think he wants to be that sort of elder statesman who can bring the warring parties together, at least to some sort of consensus. I don't think he relishes pushing through things on the Democratic majority that he has, because a lot of the Democrats, the prison deal is a perfect example. It was Daryl Steinberg and the Senate Democrats who went their own way on this, and he had to bring them back into the fold by compromising. So. But I think he's good at that. I think that's why he wanted to be governor in the first place.
He does have the luxury of having been there, done that.
Right. Yeah.
Got the T-shirt. He's done the job before. And so when he sits down in leadership meetings, he can run circles around these guys because he has experience in term limited second.
I think Governor Brown usually thinks he's the smartest guy in the room. But the thing is, given the current scene in Sacramento, he usually is.
He usually is. Yeah,
so
that's true. It's true. But what I look at, which I find interesting, is if the recall had not occurred in 2003, Jerry Brown might not be governor right now. Because if you play this out, Gray Davis would have served out through 2006. Mm-hmm. We would have chosen a new governor. And since Californians tend to reelect their governor, the last first-term governor to get shown the door was a gentleman named Colbert Olson, who lost in 1942. And he lost reelection in part because he was an atheist and refused to say the word, "So help me God," when he took the oath of office
really?
In 1939. Not a good way to kick off your term then as now. We tend to reelect governors in California, so 2014 right now, we'd be looking at a new governor, probably. And you might have Meg Whitman running for the first time in California. I doubt you'd have Jerry Brown running at this point. You might be looking at Gavin Newsom or Kamala Harris or Antonio Villaraigosa. And that, to me, is what's interesting, looking at the political existence in California right now. We have rather advanced, shall we say, leadership, to try to find a polite word for it. Jerry Brown, Nancy Pelosi, Dianne Feinstein, Barbara Boxer, John Burton, the state party chairman, have a lot of candles on the cake. The ambitious 30, 40-something Democrats who should be higher up on the political ladder right now are stalled. They're waiting for that next opening. Maybe it occurs as early as 2016. Well, 2014, we assume, is out with Brown, but maybe it occurs in 2016. If Barbara Boxer, who I think is 72 right now, she doesn't run for another 6 years, but Feinstein just ran in 2012, and she was 78 when she ran. I get dizzy with these numbers. So 2018 is probably the big opening. It's the big opening for Democrats in terms of the hyper-ambitious sorts like Newsom who'd want to run for the Senate if Feinstein steps down, or governorship since Brown is term limited, but also getting back to that very sad animal called the California Republican Party. If you're looking at the California GOP getting back in the game, you forget 2014, you forget 2016, 2018 is your natural landing spot when you have these.
And keep in mind, it's not only the people who are on the scene at this moment, like the Gavin Newsoms and Kamala Harris's.
Right.
You're going to see some people from the recent past coming back. You can bet on seeing Steve Wesley again. He's already said so, basically, in some capacity.
How about John Garamendi? You think Garamendi has another one in him?
I think John Garamendi fought for that seat in the House, and he's going to hold on to it as long as the voters of that district choose
right.
to keep sending him there. So,
Do you think we will see another wealthy millionaire run for office? Because if I'm sitting around Silicon Valley and I've climbed the mountain of business and I've got $200 million or $400 million to my name, and somebody says, I think you'd be an idiot for running for governor, so therefore the switch goes on, I want to run for governor. Having seen what happened to Meg in 2010, would I dare want to get in that situation of being not just politically but personally eviscerated? I'm not sure we're going to see a wealthy person in California
really
want to get into it anytime soon.
I'm not necessarily convinced that there won't be any, you know, people who try to parlay money into it. I think they will be more thoughtful about what kind of a candidate they are and what they actually are going to run on, rather than depending only on the fact that they are millionaires. Because I think that was Meg Whitman's main problem.
Yeah.
She had money. She did not have a convincing or easily communicable message.
Would you say the same for Carly Fiorina?
Yeah. But, you know, if I had those resources, you know what I think I would do? I'd probably play at the ballot box in the initiative side of things. I'd just say, instead of putting myself out there and thus opening myself up to all sorts of political and personal attacks, I'll just park $40 million of my dollars.
So you'd rather be a Munger than a Whitman?
Well, look at the scoreboard.
Right.
Well, before we head on to our next topic, just Gavin Newsom, if he goes for the Senate seat or eventually gubernatorial seat, do you think he'd win statewide? I mean, he won statewide as lieutenant governor, but, I mean, that's not a real office.
Well, it's funny. If you looked at him in 2004, Gavin Newsom had problems with his own party.
Yeah.
John Kerry's campaign wanted to lynch him. Because why? Because he was pushing for same-sex marriage in San Francisco at a time when the Kerry campaign was worried about a same-sex initiative in Ohio.
Yeah.
So Newsom, to his credit, very much to his credit, was ahead of the curve on that issue. I don't see him have any trouble getting elected to a higher office in 2018. The question, though, is if he and Kamala Harris, the Attorney General, are on a collision course. In theory, the two people need to sit down. If it's just those two people vying, they need to sit down and kind of divide the spoils and decide which of us wants to be a senator and which of us wants to be a governor. Of course, it's never that simple. There are more than two people who aspire to this, but yeah, I think the office is there for if he wants it.
I think there will be more people involved in those races, and I also think that we've only yet begun to understand what the top two primary system does to these races.
Right.
I think Pete Stark found out real fast, although that was partly, in large part, Pete Stark's fault. But you've got a fascinating House race running right now here in Silicon Valley between your incumbent Mike Honda in San Jose and a young Obama administration official named Ro Khanna, who's running against him, another Democrat, and you can be sure that they will be the two on the ballot in that relatively heavily Democratic district come November. So when you think about these races, these gubernatorial and Senate races several years out, don't necessarily assume that it's not your traditional Republican primary, your traditional Democratic primary. All of those candidates are in the same primary now, and the two who finish on top advance. Right, so it's different mechanics, I think they'll have a grasp on it by then, but it does change the calculus a little bit.
Very good. I wanted to, if we still have some time today, talk about, I mean, we're talking into microphones here. This topic is the NSA basically making everyone talk into a microphone at all times.
This has actually been a story that's been around for a number of months, of course. I've been surprised in that just when I think it's kind of receding, another revelation comes out. They're reading your emails. They're accessing technology services through the back end. They're Skyping your children during breakfast or something. I don't know. But it started off during that, what was it? It was kind of like President Obama's week or two of scandals back in April or May or whatever. It seems to somewhat have separated from him and just become the standalone issue of how do we deal with the need to do you know, surveillance that deals with that addresses national security issues, and oh my God, how is this going to hurt my Google stock? Josh, what do you think has happened to this whole topic, and should the average person who is not texting Al Qaeda or emailing nuclear?
Is anybody here texting Al Qaeda?
If you do,
don't raise your hand.
If you're tweeting, use CW Club in the thing.
You know, the president was here in San Jose, actually, during the news cycle that the original surveillance news was breaking. And so that was a fascinating press conference to be in on. But yes, I think it has moved away from him. I think people realize that this is a beast that got let off the leash long before he was the president of the United States. And we're at a point now, you know, where a lot of people think that it would be a good time to put this surveillance genie back in the bottle. That said, the president today, gave his official notice that he's extending for another year the state of national emergency that was declared on September 14th, 2001. Mm-hmm. So the terrorist threat continues as far as the Obama administration is concerned, and so he will proceed appropriately. But the news keeps getting bad. I mean, today's headline, today's lead is National Security Agency personnel regularly searched call tracking data using thousands of numbers that had not been vetted in accordance with court-ordered procedures, according to previously secret legal filings and court opinions released by the Obama administration Tuesday. So at every turn, there's like a, you know, there's somebody saying, oh, we wouldn't do that, we haven't done that, we're not going to do that. And then about a couple of weeks later, it says, yeah, we might have done that, but we don't do it anymore. The problem is we don't know if they're doing it anymore, and that's what the social media companies, you know, you mentioned the Google stock, Google, Facebook, you know, all of these companies are in a position where they can't adequately answer the question, is there something you're not telling us? Because either they're precluded by law from answering it, and some of them have gone to court to fight that, or they just don't know, you know, in the case of some of this encryption stuff.
The other day the news came out that the government is actually able to crack your smartphone codes and read what's going on in your smartphones. They can track your calls, your messaging, and so forth, which actually I found kind of, it tells me, I have friends who have 10-year-olds who can program their smartphones. That tells me my government's smarter than a 10-year-old, so I take a little consolation out of that. Notice how
Been a certain note of, did you really think they weren't doing this kind of stuff? You know, to think they're not.
I think you got into what's at the gist here. When the president is interviewed about the NSA, he defends the NSA. And he says, look, I reviewed what they're up to. I've studied their practices. I've been briefed on this. I have confidence in what they're doing. The problem is the president has access to things that you and I will never get access to, for obvious reasons.
Right.
So, in essence, this becomes a discussion of how much do you trust your government. So, what can be worse than trying to pitch a message of trust your government at a time when people have very little institutional confidence in their government?
In fairness to President Obama, I should note that this latest revelation of malfeasance by the NSA supposedly went on for about 3 years until they were discovered in March 2009. So this was mostly before his watch.
Okay. Well, I think it's time we turn to some of our questions. We've got some great questions here from the audience. And this one actually isn't one we talked about, though it brings to mind mentioning, of course, talking about Gavin Newsom, the lieutenant governor. And in the green room before this program, we were talking about Gavin Newsom, who was at the Commonwealth Club just a week or two ago, where he was in conversation with Mark Leibovich, the author of This Town. And if any of you have been following the controversy around that book, it's basically an expose of
Oh, how do you even describe it? It's the Washington...
It's the culture of Washington and how it's just sort of one big insider's game where people play off each other and make money off each other, and any arguments you see on TV are basically staged entertainment, and it's just, it's...
Yeah.
Have you read the
You're
book?
You're not buying it.
I grew up in Washington. But if you drive it, how many of you have flown into Dulles Airport recently? So of hands. If you fly into Dulles and then take the flyer into town, as you notice driving into town, there's construction going on anywhere. I grew up in Washington years and years ago when if you drove outside the Capitol Beltway, you were in the South. You were out in Civil War battlefields and farms and all that, and now it's just one big massive sprawl. That is in part government. There's so much money involved in government now, not just government spending, but consulting a government, working off a government, and that's part of what he gets into the book, just how it's become this big money-making machine for politicians, former politicians, and those who love them.
My time in Washington was relegated to just one summer internship. This would have been in the early 90s, but even then, you could just see the development that was coming to the city, and you would have blocks of basically almost burned out blocks of just terrible areas. And then you'd have these, you know, the next couple blocks would be these brand new, you know, solid, expensive looking office buildings that had been put up because the money was just starting to flow so fast and so big. They were just going into areas they wouldn't have built in before. And it was obvious there even that something was really happening as far as certainly where the power was flowing. Have you read the book, Josh?
I have not.
If not, you've avoided that one.
Very good. For the time being.
Well, heading back to California, someone asks, why can't Jerry Brown try to fix the UC system and the prison mess? It sounds like he has tried to do something on the prison system. What would you say about his campus work?
Well, fix the UC system, that's, you know, I don't know who asked the question, but that's... That is such a broad-raising question. I mean, it's the question, do we need to address the curriculum in the UC? Do we need to address the financial situation? So, I would suggest, though, in a second term for Brown, this would be an interesting approach to go along, especially since his father was a great builder of the system, and that is maybe look at the 21st century mission of the UC and see what we're educating people in, what areas we can drive them into, and find ways to maybe make it more affordable for kids as well.
Yeah, I think it's all dependent on the budget staying in its current and rare state of balance.
Yeah.
You know, we had this boost from the new tax revenue. We were able to fulfill our obligations to K-12 in a way that we've been lacking for a while.
Yeah.
If this continues, the forecasts seem good, but if the economic recovery continues inching upward and if the budget remains in balance, then perhaps you'll see more
funding. In UC's defense, U.S. News Report just came out today with its college rankings, and Berkeley was the top-rated public university in America. Congratulations, you Cal folks.
Sorry, Stanford folks.
Stanford came in fifth overall, I believe.
Fifth overall.
Yeah.
I blame myself.
Okay, here's another question. This is referring, we were talking about the ranked choice voting. Why would we have open primaries when it failed and was repealed years ago? Because of the corruption involved.
Because then State Senator Abel Maldonado sold his vote for a Democratic budget in return for getting the top two primary system on the ballot as a ballot measure. And the voters of California approved it soundly. And now that's where we are.
Yeah.
That is why.
If it doesn't work out in 20 years,
then we'll repeal that too and go back to the old system.
What could go wrong?
What could go wrong?
Do you think high-speed rail will be built in California, or is that one of the things Jerry Brown won't be able to do?
Well, under the guise of John Kerry meeting with the Russian official, maybe he needs to sit down with the judge, which is trying to figure out where to go forward on this. My understanding, I'm not a high-speed rail expert, but a judge has looked at this and has come to two conclusions. Number one, the funding is uncertain. But second, and what may be more problematic, is that the initial promise of high-speed rail, which was to build a system which would take you from San Francisco to L.A., and I believe 2 hours and 40 minutes, that ain't going to happen, in large part because of what happens down here in the peninsula. You have to slow down to get from here to San Jose. So we'll see if it holds muster with the judge. Maybe it comes through. But then after that, you get into the question of where's the money going to come from, because it's not going to come from Washington.
How long are you willing to wait? You know, I mean, Bay Bridge is just a bridge, and you saw how long that took to come to an agreement.
My question is this. Is it more sensible for the state of California to keep throwing money into high-speed rail and look for it elsewhere to build it, which you, every year you're building on a technology which is 1 year older, since high-speed rail has been in effect in Japan since, what, the 70s, I believe. So if you're the state of California, do you invest in high-speed rail, or maybe do you invest in, you know, what Elon Musk is talking about?
Hyperloop.
Yeah. I think, you know, we have to consider what we define as our infrastructure going forward in the next century also. You know, is it all about moving people the way that it has been in the last century? To some extent, yes, you still need to move people from point A to point B.
I just want to make sure the damn bridge doesn't fall down in the next...
Yeah, having the bridge stay up in the next big one would be great. But, I mean, in terms of high-speed rail or the Hyperloop, which I just love seeing the little cutaway diagrams of, since it doesn't actually exist, you know, we are an information society, supposedly, especially here, right here, where we're sitting in this region. And, you know, I think when you're making investments, you know, do you want to move people? Do you want to move information? There are different ways of coming at some of these problems, and I'm not sure necessarily that people are going to feel the need for high-speed rail. They certainly don't feel the need for it at the cost that it's coming in at now, the way they did a couple of years ago. I think in 20 years from now, they're going to think of it even less. So
I can guarantee they could get it through the Assembly 680 if they call it the Jerry Brown Memorial Hyperloop. So. Just a suggestion I'll throw out there. What do you think of the hiring of Janet Napolitano to head the UC system, the head of the Homeland Security, heading to the state to head up our state?
Do we call her Madam Secretary, Madam President?
Well, Matt Drudge called her a big sis, didn't he? So
big sis?
Big prez. It's a surprise because most large public universities tend to pick somebody from within the academia world, such as a provost in another school or something like that. So. Yeah. But they didn't. They didn't want Condoleezza Rice, I guess. They wanted Janet Napolitano. I don't know. She hasn't stepped out yet and really kind of indicated what her signature is going to be there. So,
Obamacare. How big a deal is it that Congress is exempt from Obamacare and the rest of us must comply?
It's not.
That pops up a lot as a question and criticism. So
yeah,
I think
it's more of an emotional appeal than a practical appeal. You know, I think, you know, ultimately, you know, there's no way to talk about Obamacare without sounding like you have an axe to grind. So, here goes. Let's remember that an individual insurance mandate was a conservative idea. When first floated. I believe it originated in the Heritage Foundation, actually, but it was a conservative idea. And what we're talking about here is a massive, massive expansion of the private insurance industry, for better or worse, whether it works or not. And what, 535 people in Washington are or are not subject to, I don't think has a lot to do with how it's going to work for the other 250 million Americans. And the jury may well still be out on that, but I don't think Congress is exceptional.
I think it's a great applause line at Republican conventions. Right. I think if I were running against you for office and I were a Republican and you're a Democratic, hypothetically, I would use that as you being an example of what's wrong with Washington. Right. But in terms of really moving things, it might take the public's approval of Washington from 15 to 14% or something like that. So
is it as high as 15?
As high as that. No, it's Josh is right. It's not.
They're rebounding. Okay, well, another thing that's thrown around a lot, at least in Washington, is impeachment. And again, we saw them talking about this in terms of Syria. If there are troops on the ground, Obama could be impeached. There are various disgruntled congressmen who say they could impeach Obama. They just don't. They're just not going to right now.
Because never Cornel the West, the black academician, the other day called for his impeachment if he fires missiles. So it's
who did
Cornel West? Yeah, the Princeton professor.
I think that's a bridge you can cross if and when he's nuts enough to put troops on the ground in Syria, which I don't think that's going to happen. And if it did happen, I don't think he'd be impeached for it.
If I were the president of the United States and I wanted a president for 2014, I would say, by all means, please impeach me, because look what it did for Democrats in 1998.
Right. Okay. We are not economists up here, but this is a fun question. When do you believe the next U.S. recession will be, roughly? And what will prompt it, considering 2008 was mortgage and
Josh is doing calculations.
No, I was just counting down, actually. let me be the rosy optimist and point out that job growth has continued consistently for many, many moons. And while it perhaps and almost definitely is not fast enough to make up for the losses that we had, I think we're just still generally headed in the right direction, albeit at the wrong speed. You know, I think a lot of people, especially when they are hurting, as many people I know professionally and personally have been, the impetus, you know, your gut reaction is to say, yes, this is bad, this is no good, we're headed in the wrong direction. I think factually that's not accurate, and I think that, well, I'll leave it at that.
Commonwealth had a very good podcast a few weeks ago with a group of economists, including Michael Boskin, who's a colleague of mine at the Hoover Institution. And if I remember correctly, Boskin talked about a shallow recovery, but a recovery that people see going on for the immediate future. And by that, I would say at least 5 years or so. So I don't think there'll be a recession overnight or tomorrow necessarily. We're just going to be a prolonged growth, but slow growth, frustrating growth.
Don't confuse being only halfway back up the cliff with still being falling. You know, it's a matter of trend.
So is that optimistic enough for you? Well, let's do one more question here before we do our news quiz. And that is just, we talked a bit about Gavin Newsom, whether or not there will be any multimillionaires throwing their hats in the ring. Any other candidates you kind of see coming on the scene for the next gubernatorial election you might want to challenge?
I'm looking at Eric Garcetti, the new mayor of Los Angeles. Now, historically, being the mayor of Los Angeles is a dead end for statewide politics. Ask Richard Reardon, who tried and failed when he ran for governor. Ask Tom Bradley, who failed twice at running for governor. Sam Yorty. The list goes on. Garcetti is ambitious. He is young. He is Newsom-like in terms of style and demeanor. He's a Rhodes Scholar.
Good hair.
And he is the mayor of a very messy city right now that has a lot of challenges ahead. But if he can turn around Los Angeles in the next 4 years, he would run for re-election in 2017, I believe, and he'd be in position to do some damage statewide if he so chose. So that's one person I would look at.
Very good. Josh, anyone you want to?
Only the one I mentioned before, and that's because he actually told me face-to-face that he's probably going to run for something in 2018, and that's former state controller, 2006 Democratic primary gubernatorial candidate, and very, very rich person, Steve Westley, from right here in Silicon Valley.
And I'm guessing Bob Filner has run his last campaign, so. Yeah.
Very good. Yeah. Well, now, I believe we have one person who has already agreed to be on our news quiz, Phil Prince. Can you raise your hand? Can you come on up here? There's a stairway over there. And do we have another person who would like to take part? We're going to put two people. We're going to ask them each 5 questions. Did I mention the wonderful prizes that they got? Can I have one more person? Honestly, this is painless. It's fun. This is your moment.
Come on.
You, sir. Come on down.
You really need some Price is Right music or something like that.
I've got to give away, houses and things like that. You're Phil?
Yes.
Okay. Oh, sorry. And you, sir, what's your name?
Chuck Nolan.
Chuck? Okay, so we have Phil and Chuck. I'm going to have Phil first. Why don't you come on over here? And is this microphone on?
Hello?
Yes, great. Why don't you answer into there? Phil, you'll go first. I'll ask you 5 questions. And then we'll do Chuck. If there's a tie, we have some tiebreaker questions. So.
Oh, wish I had a memory.
We should have the light shining right in your face so that... Okay, so
that's
your first
not the problem.
Phil's first question. What former politician took to YouTube to declare, quote, it's time to bomb Obamacare?
Former politician.
Former politician. What would be a good hint? I'll just say it's a female. Or she's a female, I should say. You want to make
Condoleezza Rice.
No, sorry, it was our friend Sarah Palin. Go ahead, stay up there. You've got 4 more questions.
Looks like Tina Fey.
Sarah Palin, the former governor.
Oh, yeah, tried to forget about her.
Okay, next question. 4 more chances, don't worry. Why was George Zimmerman, the Florida man who was acquitted in the killing of teenager Trayvon Martin, he's back in the news? Have you seen what he's back in there for?
Yes, he was reportedly threatening his wife and was detained by police.
That's right. Okay. Your third question. Okay. President Obama found opposition to military action against Syria coming from an unusually close ally who opposes his plans to attack Syria. Very close. Very, very close. Not Bo the dog.
His wife?
That's right, Michelle Obama. Okay. Two more questions.
Should have elected her.
Former House Speaker Newt Gingrich is one of the hosts of what show that is returning to CNN?
Oh, you just can't wait to see Crossfire again, can you?
That's right. Yeah. I believe it started last night and has already been panned. Okay. Your fifth question. Who did former NBA star Dennis Rodman say was, quote, a very good guy, unquote?
Gosh, there's Kim in there somewhere, the leader of North Korea.
I'll give it to you, Kim Jong-un, that's right. Okay, that's four right, very good. Chuck, your turn. Good job, Phil. Okay. Chuck, voters headed to the polls today for a primary election to select the new mayor of what city?
New York.
That's right. U.S. News, well, actually, we did answer that one. Who is startling people around the world by making unexpected personal phone calls to them? This is someone you would not think would do this. He wears white. It's not Sarah Palin.
The Pope?
That's right. Pope Francis. He's also online now, so watch out. He might be emailing you. What city was chosen to host the 2020 Olympic Summer Games?
Tokyo.
That's right. Two more to go. Well, this is a very unhappy question. In a survey of 10,000 men in Asian countries, what percentage admitted committing rape? Did you see this news story?
I'm going to have to guess from knowing the culture and say 60%.
It was 25%. Mm-hmm. And one more question. If you get this right, it'll be tied. If you miss it, then Phil's our world champion here. According to another new survey, more than half of people in what profession said they would not go into that profession again if they had the chance to do it over?
Medicine.
You're right. Okay, we have a tie, folks. So,
you look great. You guys.
Good time.
Let's try one new. Let's try a tiebreaker here. And if you both win it, well, then we'll just give you both a bottle of wine. Yeah.
Hey.
And I guess the only, let's see, the best way to do this would be whoever thinks you know the answer, you just raise your hand first. We're really high tech on this. It's a really tough question. You ready? What company unveiled its latest smartphone?
Apple.
That's right. Well, very good. A hand for both of them. And congratulations, Phil. Thank you. Let's hand out our priceless prizes here, California cuisine and good food, and a bottle of wine to wash it down. Thank you both, gentlemen. That's our program for this week. Don't forget to join us our next evening week-to-week program in San Francisco on Monday, October 14th. Thank you to our panel, Josh Richman, Bill Whalen, and thanks to all of you for coming out here tonight. Have a great week. Thank you. Josh?
Thank you very much. It's a lot of fun.